The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 36 in the Blue Cliff Record. Changsha goes picnicking. One day, Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, Master?" Sha said, "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First, I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned, following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the sense of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses." And Shui Do added the remark, "I am grateful for your reply." And the poem, the verse that goes along with this, goes like this. The earth is clear of any dust. Whose eyes do not open? First, he went following the fragrant grasses. Then he returned, pursuing the falling flowers. A weary crane alights on a withered tree. A mad monkey cries on the ancient terrace. Changsha's boundless meeting. Bah. So here we have a koan that may be familiar to a number of you, or maybe you're hearing it for the first time. One of our encouragements when listening to a koan is to notice where it touches you, or if it just completely passes by and none of the words make sense, or something in between. There's no ordinary sense in understanding a koan. There's a kind of heart sense in comprehending a koan. And one like this can seem very straightforward on the surface, and it has layers and layers of meaning underneath it that directly point to all of the teachings in our Zen way. It's a very concise, rich koan. When I was looking at background material on this, which I tend to do before a koan teisho at Sesshin, I found that the second link that I was directed to was a talk I gave. That was sort of disconcerting because I had no memory of having given that talk. It was in May of 2021, and I didn't listen to it. Who knows what I said? Hopefully it was helpful at the time. If you're curious, it is on our podcast. But this koan, it comes up again and again because it's so evocative of a certain way of practicing the Dharma that Changsha really, really demonstrates. He, it turns out, is a little bit like some of the other characters that we encounter in our study and practice of koans, like some of you may remember Daishan, who was quite a combative person when he was young as a teacher, but softened as he got older. There's famous koans about him poking around and doing terrible things to teachers. And then at the very end of his life, he gets yelled at by the cook because he's come down too early for lunch. And he just bows and goes back to his room. It's a very important demonstration of the refining process that happens in Zen practice. So Daishan is always one of our heroes of refinement, we might say. But even though we don't seem to change that much over a lifetime, we're still the person we were on some level when we were small, we get refined, we get retrained. We notice things, we learn things, we shed things. There is a, what we call in Zen sudden awakening and gradual awakening. And this sudden awakening is when something just absolutely becomes clear in the moment. Everything drops away. So wonderful. But the gradual cultivation is equally important. And we see that gradual cultivation demonstrated in the lives of some of these Zen masters. So Changsha is no different. When he was young and just starting out on his career, he did have a place. He was named after the mountain in which he was teaching, Changsha. But he spent a lot of his time going around China, teaching wherever he happened to teach. And he's famous for meeting circumstances as they arise. So some of the commentaries about him say that if somebody... Oh, thank you. I was wondering who was supposed to do that. The microphone just came by. So if you missed the beginning of this Tei Show, you can just imagine what I've been saying. But anyway, back to Changsha. When he wandered around and taught in various places, he would meet the situation as it arose with the people that he was with, always changing his teaching to conform to whatever questions or misunderstandings or understandings arose in people. Sometimes he was very straightforward, sometimes very poetic and mysterious, sometimes really, really strong. And he had a nickname that was given to him by another teacher who was the student of his teacher's Dharma brother. At the time, that teacher called Changsha Uncle Sha, because if you're interested in genealogy, I can tell you more about it. basically a younger teacher, Changsha, the older teacher, they were watching the moon one night, a full moon like we've been having the last few days, and started in on one of those Zen conversations, which I won't go into, but at a certain point, they were really challenging each other. It was getting to be a little bit like, as we say, Dharma combat. And Changsha leapt in the air and landed on the other teacher and shook him. And the other teacher said, "Oh, you're a tiger." And from then on, that was his nickname, Tiger Tsen, Tsen being one part of his original name. So this great tiger who goes around challenging and meeting people directly. He's also one of the, he's kind of a very important teacher in the sense that we derive some direct teachings from him that you also might have heard. He's the guy who wrote a poem about getting to the top of the 100-foot pole. How do you step off from the top of a 100-foot pole? And this was a teaching that directly relates to this koan as well. Up there on the top of the 100-foot pole, whether you're a tiger or a bunny rabbit, if you're stuck up there, if that's all you know, this wonderful feeling of everything dropping away, the great awakening that some people experience briefly and then have to cultivate for the rest of their lives, this entry into emptiness, it's useless. He says in that poem, you have to step off the top of the 100-foot pole. You have to enter your life directly. You have to enter a life that is full of all the things that make us human, all the things that we might wish were not true about ourselves. When we have an opening to any kind of emptiness or shunyata, we say, where everything drops away, the landscape is barren. Sometimes it's referred to as the winter of practice or the late fall. There are a lot of references in this koan to this state. Everything is just so still. Nothing's happening. From that point, we sometimes think, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. Now I don't have to worry anymore about getting angry or afraid or sad. I don't have to worry about making mistakes, goofing up. I don't have to worry that I'm a good Zen student or a bad Zen student or a good Zen teacher or a bad Zen teacher. We don't have to worry about any of that because everything is just this, what we call in many of our chants, emptiness, shunyata, thusness is another translation I like. This, this is referred to in the poem that's affixed to this, where
There's mention of a weary crane alighting on a withered tree. Sometimes we talk about that withered tree, the leaves have all fallen, everything is empty, the wind blows through it, nothing, the nada of St. John of the Cross. And this kind of sense is also referred to by Changsha in his reply to the head monk when he says, it's even better than the dew dripping from the lotus leaves, a reference to that same quiet, still place. The quiet, still place, it's referred to in a few places in the Bible, the still, small voice of God that reveals itself to the prophet Isaiah. This settling down, how delicious it feels. If only the world would stop being so crazy. If only I could settle down. Maybe that's why I'm here at Sesshin, because I just want it to stop, at least quiet down a little bit. I want everything to be calm and peaceful. But Changsha was very clear, always clear, that this was not the final piece of practice, even though it's something that so many of us long for and are a bit deluded by the promises of meditation in the present marketplace, where you can listen to a guided meditation that's supposed to make you peaceful and happy. You could get better sleep and be healthier in every single way if you only can reach this wonderful place. And Changsha doesn't think it's so wonderful. There's a teaching that I actually first learned from David's teacher's teacher, Seungsan, the Korean teacher of the Zen circle. And in the Zen circle, we start at 0 degrees, we go all the way around and get to 360 degrees, which is the same as zero. And this kind of awakening, this cool wintry place is experienced at 180 degrees. We learn, we drop away, and then everything is this, everything is just thusness. And then comes the work of getting up to 360 or down to 360, however you're picturing this circle. When we get there, we have, as it says in another text, returned to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands. Everything dropping away is just a moment on the journey. The real practice is to integrate this wintry landscape with the wild, riotous colors and sounds and smells of spring. This is how we begin to live our lives fully as Zen practitioners. So Changsha says, when he's challenged by this head monk, and the challenge of the head monk is just a little bit like the challenge to Daishan from the cook when Daishan comes down early for the meal. You could read many, many ways of saying what he says into it, but there's, in many of the commentaries on this koan, there's a sense that this head monk is thinking that something's off with his teacher. You may not have heard that when I first read it, but it's one way to look at it. There's so much we don't know. These are not detailed stories. They're very stark, very plain, very unadorned. So where are you coming from? Where have you been? He asks in another translation, Master, where have you been? And I've been wandering in the mountains, says Changsha. Changsha, who was Tiger Tsen, Changsha, who would be very vigorous in his practice. He's just been wandering around. Imagine reaching a place like that in your own life. Or instead of trying so hard, putting all your effort into doing everything correctly, being successful in life, crossing everything off your to-do list, getting through all your emails, I could go on. What if you didn't spend so much time doing that, but spent some time wandering around? There are a number of translations of this word wandering, but the gist appears to be a purposeless movement from thing to thing. And he does say this when he's challenged by the, where have you been? What have you been doing? And Changsha says, oh, I've been following this and following that. Imagine yourself as Changsha, just wandering in the mountains. And there's a path, perhaps. Maybe it's marked by blazes, and maybe it's a path you've been on many, many times. But instead of following it, something calls to you, a bird song, or you see something glimmering through the trees, and it just catches you, and you have to go investigate it. And then another thing, and another thing, and another thing. This is the spirit of Changsha's wandering. From here to there, now this, now that. No purpose, no achievement, no let me see what's going on my pedometer. How many steps have I taken? None of that. Just one step after the other. Yasutani Roshi, who was my teacher, something like that. He said, in connection to this koan and also others, that this true spirit of this wandering is, I will follow wherever my toes will lead me. This is the mature, integrated version of Zen practice. I will follow wherever my toes will lead me. And of course, if we just start doing that right now, without all the years and moments and discipline of doing this practice of sitting still, staying present and upright and quiet and here, that's what lays the groundwork for this kind of wandering. It's not an ordinary kind of wandering. It's not just, let's see what happens. I don't know. It's like, all of this has a different flavor, a different taste, as a student said to me the other day. The taste of not knowing, not ordinary, not intellectual knowing, but really deeply, truly no knowing. As Bodhidharma said when he was asked who he was by the Emperor of China. In some translations, it says, I don't know, but the two Chinese words were no knowing. It's impossible to pull it all together at a certain point, to live this life of mad achievement, to accomplish things. This is a freedom that he's having. The actual words are, first, I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned following the falling flowers. Yasutani Roshi and his student Yamada Roshi also comment on this moment that this is a phrase that's used during funerals for monks and teachers. People who have devoted themselves to the way are addressed explicitly. You went pursuing the fragrant grasses, and then you returned following the falling flowers. Just sink into that for a moment, not as a concept, but as an actual description of a way of living. How amazing. And we may think, oh, I'm never going to get there. That's crazy. I'm just always going to be looking at my inbox and worried when I turn left instead of right in the Zendo and just beat myself up for every little thing and think someday I will be like Changsha. But Changsha wasn't always like Changsha. We're only like ourselves, always. So the way you can enter this koan is as yourself, not as some other person. He's setting an example of a way to be in our lives. And the head monk, in a way, challenges him or baits him. He tries to get him to compare things. He says, oh, that's very much like the sense of the spring, which is one of those commentaries that kind of kills what just was happening. Oh, yeah, I get what you're doing. I see. I understand. You are explicitly demonstrating springtime. Thank you so much. And of course, that's not what he's doing. And the head monk is stuck in his own maybe evaluation, his evaluative mind, his way of looking at everything and boxing it in. It's a nice day. It's a stormy day. I'm a good person. I'm a bad person. Everything in these little boxes. What if we were free of those boxes, of the concepts that torment us so much? The only way we can be free of them is not to stop them. You know, the mind road never ends. It's to see that we are on the mind road, on the conceptualizing road, that we are doing it. This habit that we've been doing for all of our lives, boxing life into the simplest, plainest, most ordinary way of understanding without the richness that pervades life. You know, there's a saying in the legal field. For a while I was involved with lawyers, and that's another story. But anyway, she lies like an eyewitness, was something people would say. And later, when I studied a little bit of neuropsychology and understood what was really going on that was behind that statement, in every given moment, there are billions of things going on. And human beings, in order to survive, have to narrow everything down to just a few things. So that's all we remember. I was talking to an old friend the other day about what we did on 9/11. We were actually together on 9/11 at our office. And she remembered that day totally differently. That day she had quit her job. She'd gone into our boss and said, "I'm out of here." But she remembered being at a meeting where we set up a new program on a picnic bench outside. And I remember the picnic bench, but I remember her coming by and sitting with us and saying, "I'm out of here," and leaving. Not what she remembers. These comparisons, if you talk to siblings, if you have siblings, about childhood, different stories. Lying like an eyewitness means that we select a few items, string them together into a narrative, and then that's the way life is. And it's something we rehearse again and again. So I can think, I feel the sense of who was around me that day, the blue sky, the clouds, the sense that everything was falling apart in the world, and the excitement about looking forward to new programs at my job. My friend had a very different experience, totally different, and yet a little bit of overlap. We were both there in that place. This is how it works with human beings. We can't stop it. We can't stop this diminution of experience. Instead, we have to see that we're doing it. So Changsha brilliantly responds to the monk who's trying to make things small and make sense of things and make a this or a that, a right or a wrong. He says, "Well, it's a lot better than the Anandu dripping on the lotuses." That's one thing he's doing. But he's also genuinely putting forth a teaching. It is better than the Anandu. The integration of form and emptiness is so much richer because it contains everything. When we first encounter the world of form, we think we know what's going on. We have our little narratives based on our little selection process of just a few items to string together. When all that drops away in the awakening to nothingness, to emptiness, to thusness, we feel free of all that. But then it all comes back in, and our job at that point is to really see this process of what we're doing and to step off the 100-foot pole and be fully in our lives as much as possible. And by the way, it's a circle, right? 0 to 360, and then we keep going and we keep going round and round the circle forever. Any little moment of awakening dissolves immediately into the work of integration, and the work of integration dissolves into the work of being present in the world in a certain way and then forgetting about awakening. And then it happens again, and then over and over and over again. Well, wonderful. It's deeper and deeper, bigger and bigger every time, no matter how much we've forgotten about all these experiences we've had. It doesn't matter, because this is the true self of the person of the way. So we just keep touching it again and again and again. No matter how far away we get from practice, there's no way that we're not doing practice correctly, because practice is doing us. Practice is the realization of the way things are and what it means to be human. And that's why, at the very end of the koan, Shuido, who's one of the collectors, says, "Thank you. I am grateful for your reply." Because of that pointing to, it's not just this, it's everything. One day, Changsha went wandering in the mountains. Upon returning, when he got to the gate, the head monk asked, "Where are you coming from, master?" "From wandering in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Sha said, "First, I went pursuing the fragrant grasses. Then I returned, following the falling flowers." The head monk said, "How very much like the sense of springtime." Sha said, "It even surpasses the autumn dew dripping on the lotuses." And Shui Dao added the remark, "I am grateful for your reply." Thank you. Please make yourselves comfortable. We'll have our Dharma dialogue. Here in the Zendo, we'll be passing around the microphone like we did last night. And up on the Zendo, the Zoom screen, raise your Zoom hand. And would you mind moving that a little bit? Thank you. So raise your hand if you have a comment, a question, something that you want to bring up around the talk, around the koan, around your experience at Sashin. And everything you say is just right. So we start in the Zendo with Fix.
Yeah, thank you for the talk. So you spoke about this idea of the circle and you start at zero and then you go around to 360, but there's this point of 180 on there where, these moments of realization. Generally for me, whenever I'm, I've never really experienced that thing of like everything falling away, but I've had these moments of realization that are where you can't really put words to what you're experiencing. But then following that, there's usually a period of extreme frustration with the Dharma. Like I just can't, it's just not working anymore. And then I escape. I feel the need to run away. And I was wondering what you had to say about that.
Oh, I have something to say.
Well, one of the wonderful teaching phrases is today's awakening becomes tomorrow's delusion. Right? And it's quite frustrating. It's these experiences, please don't imagine you haven't had any. All of us sitting in the Zendo have moments when we have been touched. It doesn't have to be huge, but it can be. And then the problem begins. You think this is what I've been searching for and now it's fine, but it deconstructs itself. It becomes a concept, it becomes a memory, and then we suffer, we get frustrated. Where'd it go? We doubt ourselves. So this process of opening and closing is the process of life. It's the beating heart. Right, it expands and it contracts, so this is the path we learn to walk. So we have these moments, we're touched by life itself. What could be more precious? And yet we have to let go of that again and again and again. So this open hands, whatever you try to hold on to, will cause you suffering and frustration. And this is where trust comes in. Well, I understood yesterday. I don't today. Guess I should do a little more zazen.
And, just to add on to that, it's almost the evidence that the experience itself can't keep going is the way the mind rushes in to make that concept. That's almost like, and then you have to go back really to a beginner's mind. That's what it's emphasized so much. If we dwell on all the experiences we've had, we're just dwelling on the stories. The experiences are common. So when I heard in what you said, I haven't achieved, well, that's a sure sign that it's gone. Because this is not about achieving. This is about learning to be fully human here. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing.
If I could just add something quickly too, that's the Dharma can be scary. And, you know, sometimes we compare the Dharma to the bite of a poisonous snake or our teachers or Shakyamuni himself. And sometimes we call Dharma teachers thieves because what they're taking away is all of our certainty and all of our self-possession. And so when you have those moments of revulsion, it can follow a moment when the Dharma starts to become real and there's a recoil from that. And so that becomes part of our practice, not to recoil, not to be frightened off by this truth that starts to open voice.
And I just want to underline, thank you so much for saying that. If you're thinking, sitting here and thinking, wow, Bix, nothing like that happens to me. That's another kind of concept, another kind of story that's equal to the story, I had this big experience. They're absolutely equal. They're not worth anything. Thank you, Bix. Keep it with you until I call somebody. And let's go to Barry.
Thank you for the Dharma talk and the commentaries. What beckoned to me in this koan was the image of the fallen flowers and the weary crane. Mm-hmm. And where I went with that was decline and age and moving towards death. But even flower petals on a path that are all but dead have a certain beauty to them. And cranes are among the most beautiful birds with their long necks and beaks and long legs. And having just turned 75, aging and death is on my mind, but it's also nice to have some images suggesting there's a certain beauty to that as well. So I thank you for the gift of that talk.
You're welcome. Well, and we say Zen is participating in loss, not just the rising. I think maybe when we're younger, or maybe most of the time, we just want the upward course, and we imagine someday. But it comes down, and the wonderful teaching of Zen is that this is not a problem. Getting old and feeble and forgetful. How wonderful! This is the fulfillment of life, and death is the fulfillment of life. So we do our best on the cushion to notice those stories that Alan and Melissa were talking about, and let them go. So then in the contraction, in the opening, this is the fullness of our life.
And I wouldn't even say let them go. Just see them for what they are. And be awake to them. They'll go by themselves eventually. If you try to let them go, that's yet another thing, right? You're another way of interfering, meddling with this amazing process. And Alan will know this. Isn't the crane a symbol in most Chinese and Japanese poetry for emptiness?
Yeah, also for long life.
Oh. Oh, there you go, Barry. And Barry, can you mute yourself when you're finished talking? Thank you. Yeah, don't want to send you off into the wilderness yet, but so thanks. Anybody here in the Zendo? Yep, Bill? Did you see somebody else?
Samson.
Oh, Samson. Okay, we'll get to you soon. So why don't we start with Bill?
Thank you for the talk. Really good. The first part with the pursuing the flowers and following the flowers, grasses and flowers. My heart was leading with joy. It just a wonderful feeling that I was there with him on this trek to and fro. And then we had the poem with, as Barry mentions, the crane on the withering tree, and I'm going, uh-oh. I'm going there as well. I'm getting older. This body is getting older as well. So it was sort of reorientated me on both points of view.
Yeah.
Yeah. How amazing, right? You know, that it's not just, it's again that same delusion about if I sit long enough, I'll be happy all the time. Mm-hmm. The joyous moments. So great. Like, we're all getting older, and I hope this is not a revelatory statement. We're all going to die. Right? If you don't know that now, you will know it in some future time. And if you look back, everybody who's ever existed up to a certain point in history was dead. So same thing's going to happen to us. There it is. Yeah. So very important to open to both the joy and the reality of aging, illness, and death. Thank you. Susan.
Thank you for the talk, and especially for the last sentence you said. It's not just this, it's everything. And it was this, it's everything. And I notice in this period in my life a lot of resistance to face everything. And when this morning I was watching the recording from last night, and it was about the go around, why are you here going for the sesshi? I mean, in the past, very often I was reserving a place already weeks before the sesshi. But the last few days I was really questioning, shall I really come? Shall I really show up? Mm-hmm. And as well last night I thought, shall I really go? I was not sure. And because it is about this facing everything on one hand, and on the other hand as well, that I'm here now, is I notice for myself in the previous few weeks the tendency to move away from this sangha, and it is something what I don't want. And I just wanted to say this here and making it public, so that it's for me very important to be part of the sangha, but it's as well very difficult for me. And facing all this is challenging.
Yeah, thank you, Susan. And just to put this in context, how many other people here have noticed some resistance to facing everything?
Right.
Okay, so there are a number of hands in the Zendo and on the screen, but and I don't mean to diminish that, but to say this is when practice gets real. Because it, Zen just sounds so great. It's like, you know, sign me up. Just, I want freedom. I want it all. And then everything comes. We say, I didn't want everything. and so it's this resistance that arises, this push-pull. And the instruction when this arises is to do nothing. Right, exactly as you are. You're here, not in some ways, I don't even hear you seeking, well, tell me what to do, but just saying, this is how it is, right? And this is how we face everything, by facing even the resistance to facing everything is part of the everything. And no wrong turns, going and coming, never astray. Thank you.
And just to add a bit more of what you already know, Susan, to what David said so beautifully, as you know, when you don't face everything, it's not as though everything gets discouraged and just goes, you know, it's still right there, a bunch of living for us to come out, as you truly do.
Did we lose the group? I think we did. Michael, can you text Colin? Oh, no, they're back. Oh, we lost you for a moment. Did you hear what Alan said? Oh, good. Is the camera. Thank you. Samson, you meet in the middle.
Many have already said it, but thank you for the talk. I was reflecting on hearing part of this message before, you know, that emptiness isn't the goal. And I think the first few times hearing that, being a little bit distraught, you know, like I was hoping to escape all this, like, I don't know, where's my ticket out? And thinking how, you know, some of it, I think it's just a little bit more of a narrative, but how wonderful that there's no ticket out. And I, you know, people have been sharing this different origin narratives with me, which I find particularly delightful. And, you know, one of them's this story that we've made suffering because emptiness was just not great enough. You know, like, and so this whole like path to embracing form and suffering and liberation is actually just kind of our own reward, our own path. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of that story is just another story, but I find it useful to kind of, I find it a useful narrative in my life to kind of get past this woe is my life and like I need to grab emptiness, you know. And so I was reflecting on that.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I love the, you know, the origin stories that there was emptiness, we had to create suffering. Is that what this story was? That's so speaks to my understanding, because it's like this absolute stuff, it's just waiting for us, but we add all this stuff, we just make things so complicated. But, you know, also don't want to make light of the fact that terrible things really do happen to human beings and animals and planets, and, you know, that's also true. So the idea, in a way, this is different narrative, is that emptiness and form have always been just one thing. And emptiness is never on its own, or it contains all the forms, is another way of looking at it. But also all the forms contain emptiness. So as we, those of us who are on the path of looking into the traditional teachings as koans, there's a certain point towards the end of koan training. There's no end of koan training, but towards the end of our curriculum, where you see, you have to understand life as emptiness, form, emptiness leading to form or being within form, form being within emptiness, and then some other things too. And it just blows the mind because it's concepts like, oh, give me a break. But there is a certain way that we live into this. Again, I called it the richness, I think, in the talk that I think you're pointing to. And I just heard a teaching about from the Jewish tradition that God did it, not us. So God was just, there was just light everywhere. But God fragmented themselves, I'm going to say. I think they've changed their pronouns, but anyway, into tiny bits of light everywhere. So all that light went everywhere and landed into human beings. So he made human beings with a little bit of light in each one. And our job as human beings is to touch into that light and then to connect to other human beings to make the big light again. It's not that different. You can see how human beings will construct these narratives, because that's a constructed narrative, right? From another, a different tradition about origins, that we construct these narratives to explain to ourselves. As Vic said, there are things that can't be, words can't be put to them. And yet we say something anyway. So we keep pointing towards the very thing that you're bringing up. And this becomes our personal koan. How could it be that the world is full of suffering? How could it be that I feel separate? How could it be? And, you know, answer that question any way you want. And this is what we sit with. And then Zen has one narrative that I personally really like. It's not for everybody, clearly, which is that the original self has always been here, will always be here. Even if it seems to go away, it's still here. The Buddha nature is in everything. It's like Susan pointed out, it is everything. And of course, that's what
I meant when I said that. Thank you. Okay, anybody on the Zoom screen? I'll go back to the Zendo. Anybody in the Zendo? Yes, Anne, can you come off here?
Yeah, I sort of always had trouble with the image of this 180 degrees of this vast emptiness. It's not empty. It's almost a negativeness. And they speak of it when I never see emptiness as empty. I see it as full of stuff. It's just not separated. So why is 180 degrees this sort of plane of nothingness? Or am I misinterpreting?
Well, of course you're misinterpreting. But
next question. So
there are so many terms used to point to something that cannot be described because all of our descriptions are kind of limitations. Some words used are like boundless potential. Boundlessness. So it's not a voidness, that emptiness thing. Oh, there's nothing there. And you're pointing to the fullness. So maybe it's everything is there, but nothing is separated, nothing at any distance. So it's the fullness of everything. As Melissa said, it is actually not separate from form, and form is not separate from that. So I hope that makes it clear.
And I might say that just a little differently, because yeah, words, right? It could be that what you're experiencing is more like the 360, because, and you don't dwell on the 180. And I think dwelling on the 180 isn't so great. You know, it's a stage maybe, or an experience people have. But ultimately, we have to see that this boundless sea of possibilities, it's implicit in emptiness or whatever we're going to call it, but it may not be manifesting. So we have to really orient towards the manifestation. And maybe for you, that's not so hard. So you can appreciate your own beauty. These are all words, images, all the things that we use to describe this experience. It's different for every person. They're maps, but you know the famous saying, the map is not the territory. And anybody who's ever used maps, even the noob stuff, Google Maps and all that, it's not the territory, right? You know that. It's just a little picture on a screen, and it seems to be representing reality. But there's cars going by, and there's birds calling overhead. That's not on Google Maps. So there's just so much to experience. That don't limit yourself to trying to get the right words to describe it. It's actually a felt thing. And another person who's also felt it feels it with you. That's all you have to be concerned about.
Another way to think of it too, Annie, is I was one of the first ones here by chance, by design yesterday, and this room was empty. And if it hadn't been empty, we couldn't all be here. And this couldn't all be happening. So emptiness is a space, a field of possibility. And without emptiness, we wouldn't have the 10,000 things. There wouldn't be any place to put them.
But if there wasn't, it was there.
There you go. Don't go wandering off. Well, unless you want to. Thank you. Let's go on to Orna.
Hi. Thank you for the talk. I'm kind of wondering about the wisdom of me speaking, because I've been finding it hard to settle, dropping into silence, and I've been really busy. But in a way, I think me speaking is connecting in. I'm sort of noticing the hybrid version is different again, so I'm kind of adjusting to that. No, I haven't actually. Yeah, but I felt I wanted to say I really heard about the mad monkey, and I was delighted that was included too. Yeah, and just the inclusion of it all. I'm feeling grateful for, you know, I listened to the recording, and if it's okay to mention, really grateful to hear everybody speak and Brad speak, and just this whole inclusion of it all. And listening to everybody today as well, it's really rich. And I kind of felt I was the only one hearing the mad monkey and the weary crane, because that's what I went to immediately. And I was thinking of, not that I'm familiar with the crane, but I thought of the heron, because that would, yeah, they're kind of similar big birds. But it really brought huge compassion when I thought of the weary crane. I thought, oh, wow, you know, these big wings. And I sort of felt, yeah, it just really brought compassion that maybe needing to pay some attention to this weariness, that's somewhere in there. So that's what I'm with a little bit. And that felt quite rich, but yeah. So thank you.
Yeah, you know, I'm really glad you spoke up, Lorna, because that direction, everything is it, means that you're not being settled yet, or not getting not used to the hybrid model yet, or whatever stories you're putting on yourself about what's happening, is also true. And it's the true Buddha nature manifesting itself as not settled yet, not quite sure. You know, there's no escape really in Zen, in this conception of reality, because if everything is it, then you raising your Zoom hand is 100% it, and speaking is 100% it. There's no escape from it. And after a while, I know for myself, I don't believe that often, you know, because especially when I'm feeling really bad, but it's also so comforting and reassuring. Could this be, that the koan question really, the contemplative question is, could this be it too? Mm-hmm. This too? Mm-hmm. Really? Mm-hmm. With a real genuine, my confusion, my despair, whatever it is, my frustration. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, who here in the room? Paul.
I was noticing where I got stuck in both the koan and your talk in general, like where my mind would go off. And you made mention of Daishan, which, you know, Daishan is like one of my Zen superheroes. You know, I love this image of this academic who, you know, faces reality and burns all of his notes. And there's also something about this mellowing that seems, this was where my mind was going, not exactly what you were saying. There's part of me, this is like a secret practice of my own, that I want to be more palatable. I want to meet life in a peaceful way. I would like others to see me as that as well. And it's just like I caught myself in the middle of the story as you were talking. And the truth is that I really dig curmudgeons. I like people who rage, you know, against in whatever age. I mean, you know, young or old, there is something about that, you know, just coming forward. And I'm not trying to favor one or the other as such. Yes, I have my secret practice. But this idea of who Paul is or who Paul will be, should he be the curmudgeon? Should he be the mellow, you know, person who is facing everything with equanimity? Why don't just be Paul? You know, why don't just go ahead? And it's what you were saying to Orna, this too, and almost be surprised, you know, in this idea, really, this. In the circle, this wandering way. I love the idea that our wandering way is a circle. We we don't really know where it's going. We don't really know where it's going. And I guess it's a call out to myself, you know, can I be present to each, you know, 1 degree, 180 degree, you know, 270 along that way, and just get really curious where it's going, where it's going. So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, Paul, absolutely right. You should be as Paul. And that doesn't mean that we sometimes don't want to change our karma. So there are charming curmudgeons. I actually don't know what you're talking about. I haven't met Paul the curmudgeon yet. It's like, if I did, I'm sure he'd be charming. And then there are assholes who go around, you know, making people feel miserable and taking a perverse joy in it. And, you know, I have that tendency. And I don't say, well, just be Alan the asshole. You know, I say, you know, I don't want to be causing so much evil karma. And I want to try to change that, but not change me.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. We might say how to be a better asshole.
Can you elaborate? Can you share?
We're looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah.
Thanks. Jordan.
Thank you for the talk. Felt really personal. This narrative about this teacher that starts off really fierce like a tiger and begins to kind of be refined and mellow out. I was like, oh, that's just like me, I think. And this ultimate possibility of just wandering around touched me so deeply and profoundly, because so much of my life is me trying to make the world into a better place at the cost of myself and whatever it takes, and how painful that's all been, and how maybe not productive that's even been. And the possibility of being able to just be with what's here, wandering through it, whether it's the desire to help people or self-pity, and be free in that, totally as I am now, I don't need to get anything else. It can just be this. That to me, I mean, it's enough to make you cry. It's so beautiful to me. So thank you for that.
Yeah, wonderful, Jordan. I appreciate that, taking it personally in some way. And yeah, this possibility that everything, even our dreams of our Zen career, no problem, pointing us to this moment, nothing excluded. Thank you.
Anybody else in the Zendo? Yes, over here to Will.
So many threads I could pick up on, and I'm really getting a lot out of the Dharma dialogue too. I guess I just sort of want to reformulate it for myself, that I have a friend who, like me, has a kind of work that's never finished. I mean, her employment, there's just more and more and more and more work. And she'll often say, you know, how did the afternoon go? And she'll say, I didn't get as far as I'd hoped. And she finally decided that it's going to be on her tombstone. She did not get as far as she had hoped. And I really identify with that. So, you know, there is an objective way in which I'm not where I should be, or at least the job gives me that feeling. And it will probably never go away, maybe even after retirement. I don't know if I retire. But so there is that. It's like learning to live with that feeling. And it's not pleasant, right? And it's sort of the last thing that I want to say this to, right? It's the one thing I want to get rid of, right? You know, so that feeling that there's always more, and I did not get as far as I had hoped, you know? But I guess somehow that has to be it. If only because I'm quite sure it's not going to change at this point, you know. But that's, you know, that's quite disappointing. I mean, the flowers are, you know, they wilt. They get kind of brown when they fall. Yeah. So thank you for that.
You know, you're pointing to something that I think many of us deal with these issues about too much to do, never accomplishing anything. What was the thing that's the
biggest? She did not get as far as she had hoped.
You know, that's true for, I don't know anybody that's not true. And that this quality of really seeing that the thing that's the most problematic about ourselves is probably where our greatest gift lies. To really drill into it is with this too that you brought in, right? Could this be something that is beneficial to the world? Really, you know, I was so touched by what you said, Jordan. You thought it was personal to you. Well, it was personal to me. And I'd love it if everybody could take the talks completely personally. What is it that that's stopping you, that's in your way? What's the thing? In a commentary to, there's a wonderful koan in the Gateless Gate where a priest, Ruyan, talks to himself. Some of you know this. He calls out, Master, he says, yes. And in one of the commentaries on that koan, also, I think it's by Yasutani Roshi again. No, it's by somebody else, Nyogen Senzaki. He says, the dragon enjoys its jewel as a comment to that koan. Because what he's talking about is that it's a legend that at the bottom of the ocean is a cave with a dragon living in it, protecting the wish-fulfilling jewel. And it's referred to in some of the commentaries on this koan too, because the wish-fulfilling jewel is the thing that seems unattainable, right? But it's right here, but it's disguised as a dragon in a cave at the bottom of the sea. It's disguised as, I'm never going to get everything done, I'm a failure, or you know, this, that, or the other thing, all these narratives. That's the jewel in the mouth of the dragon. And so for Senzaki to say the dragon enjoys his jewel, right? It means you have seen, oh, could it be? And investigated it, and maybe never stop investigating it, and let it blossom in you. So maybe one last comment from Adam, or question, or observation.
Oh, sure. Thank you. I wanted to say thank you to Orna specifically. I'm also for the first time on this side of the hybrid Sashin experience. So I appreciated you putting words to that that feeling of, you know, sort of settling in and trying to adjust to it. More what struck me was the mention of the heron. I encounter the heron, you know, on the trails out around here, and a thought or story that arose for me while you mentioned that is that, you know, when I feel like I have these little openings, however big they are, it's a lot like my actual encounter with the heron. I never know when they're going to happen. And when they do happen, if I happen to try and capture it, like say, take a picture of the heron is very elusive and skittish, just goes away. And no matter how much I want to try and capture it and share it with everyone else and have this beautiful image that I can hold on to, it sort of does what it's going to do. And so I really kind of appreciate that imagery of sort of just being out there wandering and then having this encounter. And then coming to face the reality of, well, I'm out there wandering around and I have to come back home. I have to get back home in some way. So return from this place of, you know, thinking that I had some insight or maybe having some insight or reveling in some beauty to the actual reality in the world of form that I need to, you know, put my feet in front of one another and get home to make dinner. So I just really appreciated you bringing the heron up and coming forward. Because I probably wouldn't have come forward had you not. So thank you, appreciate that.
I had an image, Adam, of your coming home and finding the heron there waiting for you.
And actually, that's true, in the form of your wife and your son, they're there.
Yeah, they never weren't there.
Say it again.
They never weren't there.
Right. Well, thank you all. And please resume your Zazen posture. And we'll just take a few breaths together before we move on. But we're leaving the teachers. So we're going to do that first.